Okay, great. We do record these and we send out, of course, post-session notes and reminders that people get. And if anyone's listening to this who is not getting those, just send us your contact information. You could either send it to GLOW, GHANNE, at EICC.edu, or me, MSENEW, at AOL.com. We work under a cooperative agreement with Environmental Protection Agency, and the purpose of what HMTRI does is to help communities decide if they want to or establish brownfields. We call them environmental job training programs, and those people who are submit grants and are awarded grants, we help people mentor each other and coordinate their program so they could make the best program possible. Someone just joined?
Yes, Eric Hummel with City of Oxnard.
Hey, Eric. We're just getting started. So anyway, one of the things I wanted to mention is we're not EPA, and we can't speak for EPA, but we've been doing this a long time and know environmental job training pretty well. It gives us some advantages that we're not EPA, because when the RFP comes out, EPA really can't talk about these programs in terms of how to submit your grant. What we can do, though, is we could talk about what really makes a good program good, and we will be basically following the RFP from tip to toe, and those are the same things that it takes to develop a sustainable program. This session is the 10th of 10 sessions in a cycle. We do 10 sessions in a cycle. So this is the 10th of the 10th. And in this cycle, we're having grantees. Someone just joined?
This is Pam Scher from Florida State College at Jacksonville.
Hey, Pam. Good to hear from you. We got two people from Florida. Patrick's on the line, too. I called him a dirty bum. He said it's 50 degrees up there or down there.
Yeah, it's cold.
Yeah, it's
I
cold.
Drove to work at 32 degrees.
Oh, poor thing. Glow just woke up to 11 degrees. I don't mean to be. We're venting. We're just venting. Someone else just joined?
Yes, Virgil Perry, CDC of Tampa.
Okay. Very good. As I was saying, we do have some advantages of being a grantee. We can talk about these job training programs not as an EPA operation or policy, so anything we say you have to take with a grain of salt. But we have been doing this for a long time, and we know exactly what it takes to develop a good proposal and a program. So, but more important than what we have to say is what our mentors have to say, and we've got some great people on the call, like Ray, and we're going to have Sherry and Patrick on the line who have done this very successfully. And before I introduce them, I just want to turn this over to Glow. We usually do any news from Washington that you might have heard this week, Glow?
I think it's too cold up there, too, because they had no news this morning when I talked to them. So I take that to mean that the RFP is still under review and that they still are on the same timeline to release it in the next couple of weeks or so. I would think that if that changed, that they would let me know, and I haven't heard anything different so far.
Okay. Two things coming up. As I had said, this is the 10th of 10th for this cycle, but because the RFP, which will probably be issued, and I keep saying this, before the next PLC, the next PLC is going to be on December 3rd, and we're going to start that cycle by talking about all of the components that it takes to develop a really killer job training program, and with the help of mentors of people like Limitless Vistas, we're going to be looking at helpful hints and things that you need to stay away from and things you need to pursue. Well, that'll start on December 3rd. On December 4th, there will be an EPA webinar, 2 to 2:30. Someone just joined? Okay. There will be a webinar, an EPA webinar, 2 to 2:30, which I'd encourage you to tune into. And I'll put how to access that if you haven't gotten it on the PLC notes. Everyone who has gotten reminders will get the PLC notes tomorrow or the next day, and we'll put those on there. GLOW has also put the PowerPoint of the first webinar, which will be almost the same as the second one, up on the Brownfields Toolbox, and we have a link to that. It's brownfields-toolbox.org, and you just go to the banner and click on it, and there's a little sentence that says if you want to get a PowerPoint presentation, click here, and there's a little blue underline. You click it, and it'll download the PowerPoint slides that EPA goes over. And probably I expect that the presentation on the 4th of December will be very similar to the one that we had on the 13th. There might be just a very few variations, but you'll probably see exactly. Sometimes it's good to hear both of them because you might have missed something on the first one. What they do is Kathleen, one of the regional coordinators, and Joe, who is the project director, will go over all of the regs of the RFP that will be issued, and there'll be plenty of time to ask questions. What's different from what we're going to be doing in the PLC is we're going to be talking about the nuts and bolts of how you might respond to those issues, how you might do your labor market assessment, how you might develop your partners. So we're focused on maybe how to write a grant. We're not a grant writing coach, but we're really working with existing grantees and as mentors and potentially new grantees and re-ups, those people who have grants and maybe resubmitting, and just people that are just brushing up on, they're helping us mentor from their experience and also just kind of checking what others are doing as it relates to their program. So we'll be, those will be things that will be happening in the next couple of weeks after Thanksgiving. Unfortunately, and this is usually what happens, these RFPs come out right about the holidays, and I wouldn't be surprised if it came out right around Thanksgiving. I'm hoping that they'll extend the deadline, which is somewhere in, wasn't it in January? I'm hoping they're going to extend that to maybe February.
Yeah, so he was talking January 15th, I think.
And I'm hoping they'll extend it a little bit because we got the Thanksgiving holiday and then the Christmas holiday. And particular community colleges are closed. The other thing is a lot of mayor's offices are kind of shut down. And one of the things I'm going to be putting some, even though I'm jumping the gun, some things that you should do now before the RFP is issued. I'll put those in the post-session notes. One of those that's very important is contacting your regional coordinator. And I'll have those contact phone numbers and emails in the post-session notes, which you'll get in a day or two. And you just give them a call and tell them you're thinking of submitting a proposal, and they'd like to just have that information at hand. So with those announcements out of the way, I'd like to introduce Patrick and Sherry from Limitless Vistas. We all know what happened after Katrina, and what we may not know is or appreciate is all the work and the hard work that had to be done following that. But Limitless Vistas, is they first applied for a grant in 2010, and then they were re-upped again in 12, and they just got a new grant. So it'd be interesting to hear. They obviously are doing things well. And as I said, in this cycle, we're looking at our best grantees, and certainly Limitless Vistas are one of those. So Patrick, you and Sherry want to take over the call and tell us about
your program? Sure thing. Thanks, Mike. So as Mike indicated, I'm Patrick Barnes, and I'm the founder of Limitless Vistas, and I'll be assisted by, I'm here in Orlando, 50 degrees. I guess New Orleans is a little bit better right now. Sherry said it was 56 there, so Sherry and Christina are on the line there from our program, which is based primarily in New Orleans. I started Limitless Vistas post-Katrina to try to help with some of the devastation, some of the rebuilding, and connected some of the at-risk young adults that were sort of really needy at that time. Not that they're not needy now, but it was really an interesting time, and we really needed to do some things aggressively to get folks connected back to society and some opportunities for employment. So I run an engineering firm. That's my day job. I run an environmental engineering firm here in Orlando, Florida. It's one of the largest. At different times, we were the largest minority-owned environmental engineering firm. We do water, wastewater projects, environmental construction, hazardous waste management. We do land surveying. We work primarily for municipalities, city and county government, some state water managers, and so on. In 2004, after Hurricane Charley, we started working in the environmental emergency response sector with Hurricane Charley here in Central Florida. And then in 2005, Army Corps of Engineers issued an RFP after Hurricane Katrina and Rita to help respond to the debris removal management and emergency response activities in the impacted area. So my for-profit firm, which is called Barnes, Ferlin & Associates, also known as BFA Environmental, responded to the RFP. So we went to the impact zone, and we were successful, and we won a contract based on our history here with Charley. We were one of the few firms that had actually successfully responded to recent disasters. So we won a contract. Went to the impact zone, and just like, you know, just like for those who are not from New Orleans, just like what you saw on TV, it was quite devastating. And you know, I saw that as an opportunity to bring to life a program that I had previously written after implementing some environmental justice projects in the mid-90s to put folks to work from an impact area that was centered around Superfund sites. But I saw that this was a model that can work here. So we reached out to some community-based organizations in New Orleans, and we launched Limitless Vistas. And we used Limitless Vistas to recruit individuals from the New Orleans area and place on our emergency response contract. We trained them as debris removal quality assurance inspectors. And through the course of the 10 months that we were on that contract, we had employed over 100 individuals from the community in that capacity. So, which we thought was very successful, and we used that as the blueprint, applied for our 501c3 status, and successfully got that. And actually, Mike, you shortchanged us, because including the grant where we applied with Goodwill Industries, this is actually our fourth consecutive Environmental Workforce Development Job Training grant. So we're real proud of that. Although Goodwill was the fiduciary, we did all of the work on that. So we think we have a pretty good model of trying to more directly connect the individuals that we train through service learning projects to the environmental projects that are out there, either in the water, wastewater sector, or in the coastal restoration area, or for a while we were doing a lot of home weatherization work. There was a lot of funding related to that in New Orleans, and we trained individuals with our partner contractors to go in and do some home weatherization and so on. So we sort of pride ourselves on being maybe a little more connected to industry, because we're backed by an engineering firm, and we have, you know, scientists, engineers, geologists, and water resource managers. We have land surveyors, and we can bring them to LVI as resources so that we can more directly apply needed type of training to so that the individuals can you know, basically help meet the needs of industry more directly. Instead of just training in the classic remediation-related work, which we do as well, you know, we round it out by providing peripheral training in these other areas so that we can respond a little more directly to industry. So our concept is that the greatest opportunity coincides with the greatest need. That's kind of our credo, the concept that sort of drives us. We know that these areas where there's a lot of need, there's a lot of opportunity, and we don't look at it as a negative, we look at it as a positive, try to meet that. So I'm going to turn it over to Christina and Sherry. I believe Christina is going to talk a little bit about our curriculum, and then Sherry's probably going to talk about our service learning projects and some of the things that we're doing right now, how we use these projects to build good stewards out of our core members. By the way, we are a 21st Century Conservation Corps, and we really focus on citizenship and stewardship and making a connection, not just to job skills, but to the, you know, environment and citizenship and some other things. So with that, I'll turn it over to our staff over there.
Hi, this is Christina. Some of our training courses are OSHA construction safety, HAZWOPER, alternative energy source awareness, asbestos construction and supervisor training, emergency response using the FEMA incident command training, field technician basics, first aid and CPR, DOT hazmat, lead paint awareness, and environmental site assessment, solid waste management and cleanup, Superfund cleanup, and alternative techniques, underground storage tank awareness, wastewater treatment, and wetlands restoration. And all these prepare our students for entry-level environmental technician jobs, wetland restoration technicians, and also wastewater operators. I'm going to turn it over to Sherry.
So one thing that LVI does really well, I think, is tie the classroom training to hands-on activities that, for the most part, mean something to the students because they're working in their community doing community service projects. And we call them community service learning projects because we tie them back with what they've been trained in the classroom. One thing, one activity is working with Green Light New Orleans, and they have an energy efficiency program changing, and what we did for them was change incandescent light bulbs to compact fluorescent bulbs for homeowners free of charge. And that kind of ties back to the alternate energy sources that we teach that's required by EPA. And it also helps them link energy efficiency to how they treat their environment as well, which is pretty important. We also have conducted phase one environmental site assessments for local charitable housing organizations. And this definitely ties back into the whole EPA workforce development job training program. The students get to use their OSHA and HAZWOPER, their field technician basics, lead and asbestos awareness, site assessment, solid waste management, and UST trainings when we're out doing phase ones. And of course, the phase one is led by an environmental professional because they have to sign off on everything. But it's a good opportunity to get the students out there and actually see what kind of work an environmental technician does. Another one that we do is Audubon Louisiana Nature Center, and this is where our wetlands come into play. Students are out there removing invasive species, planting trees, collecting water quality samples, and providing team leader services for other volunteers. So that helps with their soft skills learning in an indirect way. And they also get to use their health and safety training a lot because they're dealing with machetes and all kinds of good tools out there. And then in addition to community service learning projects, we also offer internships. We recently had a few students out at a UST removal. One of the local brownfield contractors invited us out there. So the students were actually able to see a couple of USTs being removed from the ground, which was really exciting for them. We've also placed students on active remediation sites, and they were on paid internships, so they got to actually do some work. And then we have internships with New Orleans Sewage and Water Board at their active water and wastewater treatment facilities. And we've also had the opportunity to place students on drilling jobs so they can experience soil and groundwater sampling up front. So I think that's, you know, LBI has not only the EPA grant, but also AmeriCorps grant, and by tying those two together, we're able to offer the classroom training as well as community service projects. And it works out really well for us.
Tell us a little bit about your AmeriCorps. Is that a grant or do you, there is an AmeriCorps program where you pay a portion of the salary and then they bring in an AmeriCorps person, or do you have a grant with AmeriCorps?
We have a grant, and it's for working on public lands and either improving public lands or building or repairing trails. So that's how a lot of our wetland work is done on AmeriCorps, through the AmeriCorps grant.
Right. That grant is we're a sub-grantee to the Core Network, and they're funded by the Corporation for Community and National Service. So it's a CNCS, I think is their acronym. So that's the AmeriCorps funding.
So, and that kind of ties into your 21st century program, doesn't it? I mean, that isn't that kind of related?
Yes, it is.
To the, mm-hmm.
It is. It's all a part of, you know, there's a huge new initiative called the 21st Century Conservation Corps, which is a reboot, if you will, of the Conservation Corps from the Depression era that put people to work across the country. And basically there's a driving force now to put 100,000 young people to work in the environment, restoring the environment and outdoors activities in different capacities. So this is a federal initiative. It's tied to My Brother's Keeper and other funding elements. All of the various agencies that are partnered with it, NOAA's involved, Department of Interior involved, and so on. So we're able to link our traditional, I mean, EPA is also involved, so we're able to link our traditional environmental workforce development type training, which deals primarily with remediation, cleanup assessment type work, contamination impact type assessment work, to environmental stewardship, conservation, and ecological type work that is more tied to what you would expect out of the 21st Century Conservation Corps type movement. So that's one way our program is a little different and perhaps maybe long-term more sustainable. And this is a direction, by the way, that EPA has been taking their program. A few years ago, they added GIS, for example, that, you know, that you could train on GIS and be funded under the program. It used to be that it was very strictly defined. It had to be CERCLA-related activities, but then they broadened it again more recently to include water, wastewater, and now the latest elements were dealing with environmental resiliency, coastal restoration, and things like that. So we think that by connecting this conservation movement to the training that we provide, it makes the program much more sustainable and more beneficial to our young people, to be honest. So,
does your funding do you get funding as a subgrantee then from something that is the fiscal agent for these programs the state or
the funding? I believe ultimately no, it's not the state. It's the federal funders for the we get a stipend. I get a living wage stipend under the Corporation for Community National Service grant funding that comes through the CORE network, and that stipend enables our, because under the EPA grant obviously we don't have a stipend, but that enables us to better engage our young people longer and more. In a more sustained way, obviously they're because of that. So that's it's a good. I think a lot of the programs that are out there that are successful have a way of getting a stipend to the or some sort of wage to the people that are in the program. So that's something that we found very beneficial.
Anyone have any questions? I do have a question on recruitment and placement. Do you have recruitment issues or placement issues? How is that part of your program going?
Okay, now you and I talked about this, so it continues to be a challenge. I think that it's a lot of the work in the New Orleans area we found over the years has been sort of the recovery work. During our early years, it was much easier to get folks placed, but a lot of it was, but temporary. So we would get individuals placed on construction-type projects, and, they might be placed for 3 months, 6 months, or whatever the duration of that construction project might be, and then then they'll be looking for a job after. But that continues to kind of be an issue. We have a partnership with a few contractors that have taken on placing some of our young people, and we do have the internship program. And then we've also fed into a lot of the community colleges. After completion of our program, a lot of our students went on, to community college in lieu of going to work. So I would say it's been a mixed bag, but it does continue to be a challenge making the connection, a sustained connection to an employer, if you will. Occasionally, employers will come along and meet a group of young people. And I'm talking in past grants. For example, we had a partnership with VEC Disaster Recovery, who was doing demolition work for the city of New Orleans. This was probably maybe the first year of the second grant. And, as soon as we got our young people trained, they were bringing them in, and they were assisting with demolition inspection activities. They would go through our training, and then they would go through their training, and then they'd be hired. So it really depends on what's going on project-wise and whether or not those projects sort of facilitate the ability to bring in entry-level individuals. I think that right now we are strongly targeting coastal restoration work, and we're working with the Restore Council because they are ramping up billions of dollars of coastal restoration projects. And you know, we've been connecting to peer organizations of contractors to facilitate direct placement, even a credential. They're even talking about coming up with a credential that we can add to our training portfolio for coastal restoration work that would facilitate placement on some of these marsh creation, wetland restoration, or barrier island, rebuilding type projects, which, you know, there's several of those going on right now. So we're hopeful that that's going to be the next big avenue to placement. Now, with respect to recruitment, I don't think we have much of an issue there. There's a tremendous need, and now more by word of mouth than because we've been around a while, we can, you know, recruit, you know, strong candidates fairly regularly for the program.
Anyone have any questions of Patrick or Christina or Sherry? You've got an interesting program. You know, you brought up an interesting point. If you were training cashiers, or you've got a very large pool, anyone, they're generic jobs, anyone you train, there's a very large pool out there. There's always people coming in and going from these fields. But when you start talking about environmental technology, you're talking about much smaller little puddles, really, small. And it's sometimes a feast or famine. When Katrina hit, they were just trying to find anyone with HAZWOP or anywhere in the country to come on down there. And, of course, when that's over, then
right.
The whole thing
Yeah,
morphs.
And again, we had a similar surge after, you know, the BP disaster. You know, a lot of the individuals we had trained, and we had already trained them, so they were out of our program, but we were able to provide names to the contractors, and a lot of them got picked up, you know, say 3 or 4 months after I think we had completed training cycles, and because they needed so many individuals that had the HAZWOPR, that so a lot of them, you know, went out and participated in cleanup activities, you know, for several months to meet that need.
Mm-hmm. Do you get your referrals from the WIB, from the Workforce Investment Board, or do you put out advertising, or is it, like you say, it's primarily at this point word of mouth? Sounds like you get plenty of applicants.
I also send out flyers to mm-hmm. local colleges. New Orleans has a lot of colleges in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And then also to any of the charitable organizations, and we also have a few other nonprofits that are in the area that are training kids for other things, and so if kid might not fit in their program, they might fit in ours.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kind of switch people back and forth every once in a while.
Mm-hmm. Great idea.
Right, and you mentioned earlier. I mean, I think a big part of our sustainability or why our partners. I mean, we have quite a network of. There's a lot of nonprofits in the New Orleans area that a lot of them sprung up post Katrina, trying to provide support to the community. So we have a lot of partners that enable us to give some wraparound services, whether it be GED or soft skills or some areas that we might not be able to specifically provide. And recruitment and placement are also. A lot of our graduates go on to apprenticeship programs with other similar programs. So then by the time they're done with that program, you know, they have two or three things that they can help get placed with.
Mike Ray Sullivan, I have a question.
Yes,
first of all, I want to say hi to Sherry. Sherry and I worked in one of the groups down in Arlington together, and it was a lot of fun. So hi, Sherry, and thanks very much for your help. The sewage and water, I noticed that you do a training, probably a wastewater training, I have a couple of questions on that because I'm interested in that. Number one is, what's the extent of the training and how long is it? And does it lead to a certification? And how is the job placement? I noticed Viola Water is one of your partners there. They're nationwide and they're in this area too. I'm just wondering if it's a good avenue for job placement.
It's a really good avenue for job placement. Our program, what we do with them here before we do an internship with Sewage and Water Board or Veolia is give them the basics of water and wastewater treatment. And that way they don't walk into the plant knowing absolutely nothing. When they get to the internship at the plant, they shadow somebody. They're assigned to an employee, and they kind of shadow them for a week, and then they'll switch to a different employee for another week. And the internship is usually about 6 weeks. And that during that time, they also help train them to take the Louisiana State Wastewater Operators Board exam.
Yeah.
And that's mandated by EPA, so
yeah,
that should be across the board. It's a very hard test.
It is. How do your students fare in that exam?
We usually have one or two that pass, and those that pass are those that are really interested and actually study.
Yep.
Those that go to take it, to take, say they took it, usually don't pass. But
and the job placement, Sherry, do they get picked up when they pass this? Or it's a tough thing in the New York, in the New England area. I keep hearing it's going to open up and there's going to be a lot of jobs available, yet I'm having trouble, you know, establishing that type of a partnership because I don't think they're ready to pull the plug yet, but it is coming.
Right. They're not ready to pull the plug, but we have had several of our students get hired on as laborers as
uh-huh.
a way, as foot in the door. And once they, you know, and that was mainly through the internships.
Okay.
That way, Sewage and Water Board or Veolia can actually evaluate the student before they have to hire them.
You know, Ray and Sherry, we've run into this. All the studies we've seen, the big demand, everyone's talking about big demand, but when we look at what happened, now in the 70s, they linked the efficiency of the wastewater plant to the trained operators or the inefficiency of the plant to untrained operators. So there was a big push in EPA, Office of Water and Wastewater, to do massive training. And there was I worked in air. He worked in water, and they had a massive training program. And that's when all the wastewater training manuals came out, everything came up. Then all these people went into these wastewater plants. Well, then they stopped that training, and then the training was more proprietary. You had a couple of consultants who wrote the Bibles of wastewater training. The training in some municipalities came inward, so I don't want to say it was became a good old boy network, but you had the people that came in originally in the 70s, and then when they needed people, they kind of brought the people in, and they kind of trained them in-house, and then they nurtured them, and then, as you said, they went for their operator license. Now, all of a sudden, in the last year, EPA, through the Environmental Job Training Program, has not ever funded training for many years. Now, all of a sudden, they're contributing to the Environmental Water Waste, to Environmental Job Training Program, and there's this little bit of inkling of training, and we're a little bit caught off center here because the paradigm of getting trained operators changed from the 70s to the turn of the century. And so now we're confronted with this, not the original way we train people and place them, but now this old, not good old boy network or patronage network, but guys that got in there. And I think Sherry's got the solution here where you're able to get interns in there with some environmental training to get them in the door, and then they become familiar with the operators, and then they get to see them and they like them, and then all of a sudden they say, well, why don't you go for your operator's license? And then do you guys see this as the way it seems to be shifting out right now? This is what I'm seeing. I don't know about others.
Well, I was under the impression that in order to work as even a laborer in a wastewater facility, you needed to have wastewater 1 and 2 certification, which is, I think that's federal, but you need to take that course of study and the exam, because it is a tough one, as Sherry says, and that's my understanding of it. But again, if there was just a way where you could roll up your sleeves and work on site and learn on site in an apprenticeship types program, to me that would be more receptive to our clients and a better pathway.
You might want to look at that again, Ray, because in Louisiana, in order to take the operator's exam, you have to have 1 year experience. For most people, but Louisiana does waive that twice a year. So you can go in and take the exam, and if you pass, you get a provisional license that gets you in the door, and then you get your 1 year experience after you already have the license.
That's kind of the way it's working here, but that's like a 20 credit type course of study. It's a long course of study and then you take the exam, and then you start in an entry level position somewhere. Well, at any rate, I'm just curious as to how it worked for you, and I think that's a good approach, and I appreciate the input.
You know, we're going to be working this out in the next year or so, because we talked to Alaska. They're putting people in local plants. It depends whether you're rural or urban. I think it depends on your municipality. It looks like in New Orleans that your municipal and your water plants are willing to work with you, which is perfect. And I think this is going to, it may be a little different in each locality, but I think it's a challenge because, as Ray said, everybody's talking about how many jobs. All these old guys from the 70s are retiring, so there will be job openings.
Hey, careful there, Mike.
Yeah, you and me. Well, anyway, we got to figure out a way of that works to get our people in. What do we need? What kind of training should we be providing in our environmental technology programs to get them into the door, whether it's an internship or a traineeship or an apprenticeship? Or maybe that's not the right approach at all, and they have to go to a private training contractor, but there still has to be an opening. You know, I think this is a work in progress that we need to look at.
It is. I mean, I think that a big part of on the water wastewater side, right, you're going to have to get the buy-in from the utility sector, sure, or these municipal utility sector, which they usually have, or at least they've had mechanisms or on-ramps for folks to get trained and get into the system. But over the last 20 years, you know, those things have all sort of dissolved away, and the focus on the environmental work has all been college and university, and you know, now is we're faced with this problem of how do you fill these positions. But the good thing is folks are recognizing that there is a problem, so there's a lot of focus now on, you know, trying to meet that need, particularly by, you know, Water Environment Federation, you know, AWWA, and a lot of the national peer organizations are in for this. I mean, they're really in the fight trying to figure out how to connect these two things or these needs. But what one thing that we can do in terms of workforce development across the board in the environmental field is we got to get the private sector bought in to these training programs in terms of the value, the business value of working with our trained individuals as entry-level staff. I mean, I think that, and we're building the partners slowly, You know, we ramped up a subsidiary, if you will, of Limitless Vistas in New Orleans here in Orlando, and we've already got two partners, engineering firms, that have agreed to hire, you know, technicians after they come through our program. And I think that, and we've got similar relationships in New Orleans, but the private sector has to be a player in this piece. And EPA and and our federal partners and can help with that. They can help be more prescriptive with that in RFPs or in grants or what have you, and funding. Make statements to that effect, that, you know, we'd like you to partner with local training programs, or, you know, EPA is warming up to the idea, but, I mean, here they are doing assessment and cleanup grants, and they have a training grant, and they've been for years reluctant to make the direct connection. Look, if you have a assessment grant, you got to, you know, hire individuals from your training grant if they're in the same community. I mean, they've been reluctant to say that. But they should, and they certainly can, you know. So that more of that needs to happen to get the private sector bought in.
I think these are really two good issues, because, and for people that are starting grants now, they think they want to do wastewater, and then they find a municipality's got some other plan, or like in Chicago, they said they're taking care of their own. So we're going to keep that conversation going and seeing what other parts of the country are doing and try to ferret out some of these effective solution. And certainly Sherry and Pat have a really good solution is getting interns into the workplace. It's a good start, I think, as far as options that we've got right now. So, well, listen, we try to keep these a half hour. So thanks for joining the call. The next one we're going to do is the 3rd of December. And you all have a good Thanksgiving. Anyone have any other calls? We'll send out some post-session notes. And Pat and Sherry and Christina, is okay if I put your contact information if someone wants to continue this conversation with you one-on-one?
Sure. Yes.
Is that all right with you?
Yes.
Good. I was waiting to hear some no's. I don't want to talk to anyone. thank you. I appreciate that. Well, everyone have a good Thanksgiving.
And, all right. Thanks,
we'll
Mike.
See you after you Turkey Day.
Thanks for having
everyone.
Us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.